Hey everyone, welcome to Stutter Talk, episode 276 for May 15th, 2011, continuing the great tradition of opening with some good voluntary stuttering. Stutter Talk, changing how you think about stuttering one podcast at a time. I'm your host, Peter Reitzes, here with Dr. Philip Schneider. How are you doing tonight, Dr. Schneider?
It is a pleasure to be on Stutter Talk. Thank you, Peter, and thank everyone for listening.
It is an honor to have you back on the show. Dr. Schneider is a Stutter Talk advisor, my good friend and mentor, a speech-language pathologist with over 30 years of experience, and holds the title of Professor Emeritus of Communication Disorders at Queen's College. Phil, with his son, Ori Schneider, just published the wonderful film, Going with the Flow, A Guide to Transcending Stuttering. Once again, Phil, it is so great to have you back on Stutter Talk. I dare say you are, in many people's eyes, a modern-day Lionel Logue, and well, I could talk to you all day. So, you ready to get started?
Thank you, yes.
In the British magazine West Side, it's been reported that Colin Firth, who starred as King George VI in The King's Speech, is having trouble losing the stutter that he practiced and that he learned for The King's Speech. So, in that magazine, Mr. Firth was asked the question, most people with a stammer are trying to lose it, but you had to try and develop one. How did that work for you? And Colin Firth responded, you can probably hear even from this interview, there are moments when, it doesn't say this, but he means a stuttering, is quite infectious. You find yourself doing it, and if I start thinking about it, the worse it gets. If nothing else, it's an insight into what it feels like. What's your initial reaction to that experience, Phil?
I guess a general comment. There are people who ask, can you catch stuttering from being around other people who stutter or from, in fact, pretending to stutter and joking around with it or as in this case, being an actor. There, in my 40 years of practice, I've never met a person where the storyline was that their long-term stuttering evolved out of a role of an actor or playing around imitating someone who stuttered. I've never heard that story. What I have heard, personally, is that I know in myself, I'm someone, if I'm speaking with someone who speaks English as a second language, I begin to speak my English with their accent. I'm extremely sensitive to the speech patterns of other people. And 25, 30 years ago, when I started attending gatherings of people who stutter, myself being a person who does not yet stutter, I would find that I became progressively more disfluent and sometimes would feel awkward about that because I would think people would think I was imitating them or, in fact, that I was a person who stuttered. And so I would become more disfluent when talking about stuttering or being around a lot of people who are stuttering. But, again, I've never heard of a person catching stuttering by being with somebody who stutters in the sense that they would retain this as part of their motor behavior. The issue of an actor, in the case of Colin Firth, who worked very hard for a long time to develop the ability not just to get inside the physicality of what it is to stutter and the muscle tension and all of those physical movements and patterns, but also to get inside the emotional feeling of being out of control, of being prevented from finishing what he wants to say, of being humiliated. And good acting, and he won the Academy Award for this role, is not a simple pretend, a superficial thing. It's a really getting inside the emotions and the physicality of it. So it doesn't surprise me that he's having some stuttering-like interruptions in his speech at this point. And what would be different than when he was actually acting is when you're acting, you're doing things on purpose. And one of the key disturbing elements of stuttering is actually the opposite, feeling out of control of your body in the presence of other people. So what he's mentioning in this interview is that having spent a lot of time really developing the ability to feel all these sensations and to speak in that manner, he actually has sometimes finding he has interruptions, but for sure the feeling if he has those interruptions now would be one of discomfort as compared to when you do it on purpose and you feel totally in control, even though it looks to other people that you're stuttering.
Well, there's a lot on the table there, Phil, and that is a tremendous start. Just to clarify, or just to ask you, do you think that Colin Firth may feel now somewhat of a loss of control, or have you ever felt somewhat of a loss of control when you've come back from a stuttering conference and may notice some stuttering-like behaviors in your speech?
Well, for me, that experience never lasted. So it was just I would notice those things when I was in that setting, and being somewhat chameleon in my speech style, it would dissipate when I would be out of that setting. Sometimes when I'm talking with somebody who is stuttering a lot and we're talking about it, I may find I'm more disfluent. I don't become disturbed about it because it's never become an ongoing trait for me personally. There is someone I'm very, very close to in my life who, at the age of 18, I called them on the phone, and suddenly they began speaking as if they had been stuttering all their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Are you okay?" And they said, "Well, oh, do you mean the stuttering?" I said, "Yes." And they said, "Oh, that's no problem. I've just been spending a lot of time with a friend of mine who stutters, and actually I like him so much and admire him so much, so I consider this sort of a compliment." And then I spoke to the fellow who stutters, and he said, "Oh, yeah, all my friends find that they stutter a bit when they hang around me a lot." And but none of those people retained stuttering. And in fact, there are many, many actors who have taken on roles, very effective roles, where they've played parts of people who stutter, including Michael Palin in A Fish Called Wanda. There's never been a report of an actor retaining stuttering short of this comment. There's an interesting anecdotal story about James Earl Jones when he was asked to take a part in a movie in 1996 called A Family Thing with Robert Duvall, and the part called for a small amount of stuttering as a way of suggesting a sort of softening of this character's personality. And James Earl Jones is a person who grew up stuttering, and he was quite concerned that if he did this part, it might lead him back into the trenches of getting caught in his speech and feeling uncomfortable about it. And he gave it a lot of thought before taking on the part. But he did take the part. He did it extremely well, and as you could see if somebody watches that movie, A Family Thing, and it didn't lead to any long-term problems. So what is the sense that Colin Firth would retain difficulties, fluency difficulties? I would think as close to zero as you can get. There's one other place where this issue comes up a lot, and that's with siblings. People are sometimes asked the question, you know, is it likely that the siblings will catch it from this person? My answer is no, that siblings do not catch stuttering by being around their siblings who stutter. But sometimes stuttering does run in families, and so it's not uncommon in a family with a lot of history of stuttering, parents or grandparents, uncles and aunts and cousins, that two siblings in a family may stutter. But I don't believe that's because of imitation at all.
This is Stutter Talk. Peter Wright is speaking with Dr. Phil Schneider. Phil, earlier in the conversation, you alluded to this, and I wanted to bring up a similar experience I had, where I work in a school with many Chinese-American classrooms. So when I walk down the hall, I can walk down certain parts of the hallway and hear 60 to 80 children speaking Chinese. And sometimes I find that my body wants to try those sounds. So maybe when I'm speaking to a teacher in the hallway and I hear all these children talking, I'll hit a tone speaking English that I usually don't hit. And I know it's because I'm hearing different sounds. And I've heard my students do this too when I pick them up, maybe two Hispanic children and two Chinese children, and the Hispanic children will take, and they're not mocking the Chinese students, but I'll hear a little change in their inflection. Do you think this is similar to what we're talking about with stuttering?
Yeah, I think underneath what we're talking about is a very powerful, universal human reality which is that we do pick up the dialect of our environment. And if it weren't that way, people wouldn't be able to develop languages. If you are two immigrant parents who come to the United States speaking another language, come in your adult life and start developing English, say, in your 20s, you may speak in English, which is still tremendously influenced by the pronunciation and grammar of your first language. Your children, however, will speak the dialect of the community. They will sound like natives of whatever area they live in. They will pick up the musical pattern, the intonation, the rhythm, the pronunciation, and the grammar and vocabulary of the environment outside their household. They may get the language of their parents, but they'll be very attuned to what's going on as they, as you said, walk through the streets and interact, listening to other people. We as human beings are wired and sensitive to the rhythm, the speed, the tempo, the music, the pronunciation of the sound, and the structuring of the language of those outside of our home as well as within our home. So it's completely reasonable that when you spend a lot of time in a certain pattern, you know, you may be influenced by that. But again, not when it comes to picking up pathology. So it comes with dialect. So for example, if you spent a lot of time with people who have cerebral palsy or who are deaf, you and I would not pick up a deaf style of speaking, a deaf intonation, a deaf resonance, deaf pronunciation. So it relates to non-aberrant patterns. And that's why I think the issue of stuttering, which has to do with intermittent muscle spasms, is not something someone picks up and holds on to through imitation. You might have more interruptions as you go as part of picking up the rhythm and tempo of what's going on, but it would not be retained by you when you leave that particular environment.
So far we've been talking mostly about what happens when people who do not stutter put stuttering in their own mouths. So what about and this is a question I've heard many, many times, what about when parents or people who stutter say, you know, is it safe for me as a person who stutters to go to a conference where I will be around many other people who stutter? Will I pick up new stuttering patterns? Will I stutter more? What do you say to that?
I think the answer is yes. There's a good, not that it's unsafe, but it is likely and often occurs that people tell me, and I've observed it and I've heard it from people as well, that when they go to a conference of people who stutter, they tend to stutter more. Now, that's not a simple statement, because sometimes when they go to such an environment, they actually speak more. And sometimes they speak more freely, with more energy and more enthusiasm, a little faster, a little louder, because they're not worried about hiding the stuttering, because the environment says, in this place, stuttering is not only okay, it's part of your membership in this club. It's, in fact, why we're here. And so, yes, many people do let out more stuttering in that kind of an environment. Is it a bad thing? Does it lead to a downturn, an increase in shame and discomfort, and all the negative kinds of things that people experience? I've not heard that story. Yes, I do hear that sometimes people who stutter, when they go to these environments where you're surrounded with this and where it's okay, do stutter a bit more, and it's not necessarily a bad thing.
There are many people listening, and that's not bragging, I'm just stating that as a fact, and I'm sure somebody is saying to themselves, it sounds like these guys might be suggesting that stuttering is a little bit contagious, kind of contagious, but we're not saying that at all, right?
Stuttering is not contagious. People do not hang out with someone who stutters and then develop a long-term problem with having intermittent interruptions in their own speech. It's just not, it does not occur. It's not reported in the literature. I don't know any colleagues who've ever told me such a story. I'm practicing 40 years. I can tell you I have had a chance to speak closely with over 1,000 people who have this trait of stuttering, and none of them acquired it by having a conversation or spending some time with someone else who stutters. And again, there are many actors who have played roles where they've really had to work on developing the ability to stutter for that part, and none of them have developed any kind of lasting difficulty with speech fluency.
I will confess to you, 'cause you make me think about about the times you turned the picture on to me and I'll turn over. The picture was a masterpiece of comic timing. You wouldn't laugh at all.
And Phil, I want to share with you some thoughts I've been having on a related topic. Tomorrow I'm presenting on talking about stuttering and evidence-based review. The reason being that every month for 10 years when I go to staff development, my wonderful colleagues come up to me and the question I get, one of the top two questions I always get is it okay to talk to children about stuttering? Is it safe to say the word stuttering? So I've been preparing this presentation for weeks and putting together all the evidence I can find showing that talking about stuttering is not only safe, but it's very therapeutic. And it sort of just dawned on me over the last couple of days that maybe the problem isn't talking about stuttering. Maybe the problem is listening about stuttering. And I'm wondering if my colleagues are really expressing the question as, is it okay to talk about stuttering? But what they really mean is, I don't know how to listen to people talk about stuttering. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that the most important thing we can do as teachers, as speech pathologists, as parents, as friends, for those that we care about and love, the most powerful thing we can do to help people become healthy human beings is to listen to them. It's to set the stage that makes it safe for people to express what's on their mind and that we honor that and respect it. And it's really important to do more of that, and particularly before we start speaking about it. You can never hurt a person listening to them. You can never make a huge mistake in a relationship listening and saying, I want to know more. But tell me what you mean by that. Draw a picture about it. Give me a story about it. Give me an example. That's interesting. Wow. I wonder what, whatever. So I think you struck something really important, that the most important thing, and in my work, actually, I'm not necessarily talking about stuttering unless I think that's the word that the I like to use the language that the person in front of me is using. If they say I get stuck a lot, I may say, oh, so you get stuck. Tell me what that feels like and how you feel about that and how you deal with that. So we're talking about getting stuck. Okay. Somebody might say, I don't know, sometimes I can't get my words out. Or there are some words I can't say. I say, wow, what does it feel like when you can't say it? How do you deal with that? Can you show me? Can you teach me how to look like I can't say it or what happens? So we're talking about the issue because some words have a stigma to it. So I think it's good to talk about the issue. I wouldn't necessarily try to put words on the table that are kind of amorphous. That is, there's nothing concrete about the word stutter. It's not literal. And it has a lot of connotations to different people and maybe stigmas. So I think you can talk about the issue extremely directly, or as you say, you can set the stage to listen. I met a 9-year-old boy yesterday, and I say, are there any things about talking that are difficult for you that you'd like to see change or feel different about or handle differently? He says, yeah, sometimes there are some words I can't say. And how do you deal with it? Well, sometimes I try to find a different word, or I just keep pushing until I can say it. Oh. Well, that's interesting. So when you can't, you either change the word or you push. How does that feel when you change it? Well, sometimes I feel bad because it's not exactly what I want to say. Oh, how does it feel when you just push? Well, I think it's most important to just finish what I'm saying. Oh, that's really great because, you know, I agree with you. It's really important to finish what you're saying no matter what. And then gradually the dialogue opens up, and I follow that person's lead and use their language and explore with them what's on their mind. And I try not to open areas that they're not ready for, and I pick up my cues by the listening, exactly as you pointed out.
Wow, you said some really important things there, things that you have taught me over the years. It's giving children the opportunity to talk about stuttering, saying back to them what they've told you. And Phil, I've just learned so much from saying that phrase, tell me more. I want to know more about that. Explain that more to me. And just letting the client I just find that just a little nudge like that helps the client to really open up and to think about their speech. Phil, do you have any thoughts on that?
A lot. This is the really hit on some of probably the most powerful clinical tools that we have. Our textbooks and our lectures often talk about what we tell people to do, how we rationalize that to them or sell them on ideas. But the listening is extremely powerful. When we listen and we say, oh, I want to hear more about it, first of all, we're validating them that what they have to say has value, whatever they say. And the better we listen, the more they communicate. And in fact, what people who stutter really want is better listeners. And in fact, what all of us want is to be listened to be heard, not necessarily to be agreed with, but to be heard, to be respected for what we say. So a child says, oh, I have this and this, and it's terrible, and I hate it. And we say, oh, it's not so terrible, don't hate it. Then we haven't really done our job in listening. Listening would be, wow, I hear how upsetting that is to you. Tell me more about that and how you deal with it. And we have to go at their pace, but it's always feelings that get expressed in the open and that get validated and get healed. That's how feelings get healed. When you cut your skin, the skin grows back together. The body has a healing power. When emotions are hurt, when you've lost something in your life, when you're upset, when you're angry, when you're sad, when you're frustrated, the way you heal those feelings is often talking to someone else about them, and that person listens and validates that, yes, I hear that's how you feel. I can appreciate that. Then your feelings begin to move back toward healthier places. So, and for people who stutter, very often the feeling is people aren't listening to me. They're not listening to what I'm saying. They're noticing my stuttering. They're watching my physical status. They're not hearing the message that's driving me. So listening and validating, asking for more clarification, says what you have to say is important. It's worth my time. I am listening. Please tell me more. This is interesting. This sounds important. This sounds meaningful. Thank you so much for trusting me and sharing it. And then we can do a few more things when we listen. We can amplify what they're saying. So we can pick out something that they're saying and we can highlight it. Wow, it sounds like when you feel like your voice just stops on you, that feels so frustrating. So, you know, if that's what they're saying, we can mirror it back and focus on the emotional element, which allows them to slow down the issue of what happens to them from what response they choose. Instead of choosing reflexively to just quit talking or to begin struggling, they may start to hear the story, ah, this happens and this is how I feel. What are my choices, how to respond? So we can clarify, validate, amplify, and then there are two more things I like to try to do. De-horrify and demystify. Someone says, I'll never be able to do anything because I'll never be able to speak. I can't say the things I want to say. Oh, it sounds like often you feel you can't say some of the words that you want to say. So you put it back into a more objective place. You try to stay with their story and validate it while de-horrifying. So instead of it being everything is terrible, I'll never be able to do anything, it becomes, wow, it sounds like it felt really, really upsetting when you were unable to say that word in the moment that you wanted to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Demystify is talking about words getting stuck or lips feeling tight or voice feeling tight or stalling, as opposed to saying, oh, you're a stutterer and you're stuttering. It's hard to know what that means, but we can take away the mysticism from it by being very concrete and very physical. Oh, sometimes it takes a few extra moments before you can say your name. It's different than saying, I can never say my name.
Well, I really love what you just said. And that last point, you know, the resource of the month at Stutter Talk is a classic article by Wendell Johnson called The Belief in Magic, where he touches upon a few of the points you just brought up, that stuttering isn't something that just happens to us. It's something that we do, something we can work on. So let me just remind all the listeners to go to stuttertalk.com and check out that wonderful resource of the month. You know, Phil, every time I speak with you, I learn so much. The phrase I'm going to take away from our chat now is, this sounds important. Thank you for sharing it with me. I love it. I will remember that. I mean, I'll remember a lot of what you said, but
I have one more piece, which happened as I was listening to you. I got to clarify something that I believe. So by sharing it with you, and then you bounced it back to me, then I got something out of it. I thought, wow, yes, that is. And I wouldn't have recognized that as strongly if I had just kept it in my own head. So here's the point I want to make. When someone begins to open up and tell you, the listener, be you the role of parent, friend, sibling, teacher, therapist, whatever, that when someone feels they can trust you, and whatever they say, you will honor it, and you will hold it sacred, then that person opens more and more, and then who is listening when they become more and more in touch with what they're saying? You, the listener, and the speaker also get to hear themselves. The speaker gets to hear their inner voice, what they're feeling and what they're thinking, and they get clearer. So even if you say nothing and you just listen and nod, and go, wow, with real sincerity, but try to understand them, then the speaker gets to know themselves better. And sometimes the speaker goes away and says, thank you very much, you've really helped me. And you say, I didn't even say a word. And they say, no, your listening helped me hear what I need. I now have a better sense of my needs and what I need to do to achieve those needs.
It reminds me of a show I did a couple months ago with Dr. Brian Smart, who's also a Stutter Talk advisor, and he was talking about his own speech therapy, and I asked him a question about whether his clinicians really got stuttering. And he's like, that's not the point. They just gave a damn. They listened to me. That's what they got.
I think you've also interviewed or highlighted a resource by David Luderman, who provides such good materials on the issue of counseling skills.
Yes.
And I'm sure that he there's a nice DVD available with him. He covers these things very nicely, too. And so I think that it is our most powerful tool as professionals and as people who care about other people. So this works in friendship, it works in business, it works in family, it works in speech therapy, listening. And anything we can do to become better listeners, active listeners, will help us help other people in all relationships.
Hmm. Agreed. This is Stutter Talk, speaking with Dr. Phil Schneider. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Schneider and see some of his wonderful videos, you can go to SchneiderSpeech.com, SchneiderSpeech.com. Phil, can I share with you just one more story?
Please, yes.
I was working, or I am working, with a child who stutters, and this child last week was awarded a very prestigious award by their school. And with the award comes a speech in front of the entire school, in front of parents. And the child came to speech class trembling. So the parents had said, we're coming, this is a great award, everybody's happy, and we'd love you to work with our child on helping them prepare for this speech. And the child was really not in a good place. And I said, what's the matter? And the child said to me, it's not fair. I shouldn't have to dread this day. I've worked so hard for it. And now I don't want anything to do with it because I'm going to have to talk and it's going to ruin everything. And I said to the child, it really sounds like it's not fair. And that you shouldn't have your day ruined, and you're absolutely right, and we're going to talk to your parents and let them know. And we went out to the waiting room, talked to the child's parents, and we said to the child, you don't have to do this. You can accept the award and not give the speech. That's okay. We respect how you feel. The child sent me an email and had said, I'm ready. I want to do this. And the child got there on their own. And I think that just as you said, valuing that it's not fair and the child shouldn't have to dread it, and saying, you're right, it's okay, the way you feel is reasonable. And then the child on their own decided that they wanted to take on the challenge.
Well, I think you did something really profound, and the process didn't surprise me. It won't always unfold so quickly. When a person feels forced to do something against their comfort zone, once they have the option, then they can relax, they can feel protected by the adults in the environment, and then very often they're ready to take a larger risk.
Gina, I'm so glad we're talking about this because I'm trying to figure out in my head, you know, we did something right. And I think you just really hit it. We showed the child not only that we respected the child, but that we're there to protect the child.
Created a safety zone. Child who's dealing with the world of adults. Children don't feel they can go up and tell a teacher, well, I don't feel like doing this today. They don't feel entitled. They feel like lesser citizen because they're a child and not an adult, as opposed to a full human being with full rights. And there's certain things we wouldn't do to a colleague or a friend. We wouldn't stand them up in front of other people against their will and humiliate them. But sometimes we feel entitled to do this to children without asking their permission. So if you create safety for children, you're really being respectful. They will appreciate that. They'll feel the safety, and they'll be able to take larger risks.
Mm-hmm. And Phil, I think that is a great place to leave the conversation. This is Stutter Talk. Peter writes us here with Dr. Phil Schneider. Phil can be contacted at schneiderspeech.com. SCHNEIDERspeech.com. Thanks for joining me, Phil.
Truly a pleasure and an honor.
I am Superman.